I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they make and the poems they love.
Poetry's about anarchy, it's about mystery, it's about dreams, it's about, you know, the unknown.
I made myself anew in poetry.
The poem invites the world to come celebrate.
My name is Erica Meitner, and my poem is, I'll remember you as you were, not as what you'll become. If you are fearful, America, I can tell you I am too. I worry about my body, the way lately it marches itself over curbs and barriers, lingers in the streets as a form of resistance. The streets belong to no one and everyone, and are a guide for motion, but we are so numerous, there is no pavement left on which to release our bodies, like a river spilling over a dam. So instead, my body thrums next to yours in place. When we stop traffic or hold hands to form a human chain, we become a neon open sign singing into the night miles from home, when the only home left is memory, your body, my body, our scars, the dark punctuated with the dying light of stars.
Thank you for reading it. It's just such a, it's such a striking poem. And it is the last poem in your collection, which is, I think, is interesting. It's an interesting poem to go out on. It's a very powerful poem. I wonder if you
Thank
could
you.
Speak a little bit about where the poem ends. And there's a you in the title, I'll remember you as you were, not as what you'll become. And then the first line of the poem, if you are fearful, America, I can tell you I am too. So, you know, your reader is sort of confident in the you there being America. This is a poem to America. But then the poem really kind of, the you seems to become over the course of the poem an actual individual. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how you moved toward the ending of the poem and a little bit about that.
Sure. So this poem was an interesting poem in that it's one that I wrote after attending the Women's March in Washington, D.C. in January of 2017. And one of the experiences that's so physical about being out in the street during a march, particularly one like that one where it was so crowded, was that, you know, I was literally stuck in the street at various points, which is the experience that inspired this poem. But then one of the things I was really exploring in my new book, Holy Moly Carry Me, was the injunction in Leviticus, you should love your neighbor as yourself. And what does that actually mean? And so that shift in the you from America to a more intimate I-you relationship in that second stanza to me really encompasses the tension in that idea of what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself when you're really different? What does it mean to have a collective experience as people in a country when we're supposed to be really bifurcated? You know, I have two little kids, and they always, my oldest one who's in sixth grade, he loves factoids. And so he was really into this idea that the light that we see from stars, the stars are already dead. And that's something that wended its way into this ending, which to me feels somehow simultaneously, I think, uplifting and a little depressing at the same time, in the sense that there's a light, but it's a dying light.
And what you've just said relates to the great title of the poem, I'll remember you as you were, not as what you will become. Like, there, how can you remember something that will happen in the future, you know, not as what you'll become? I mean, I get it. There's like in the intervening time between when I have, you know, had this experience and when I am writing the poem, I guess. But that those last lines to me, you know, you naturally get to the end of a poem, or at least I do. I naturally get to the end of the poem and kind of go back and linger a little bit more on the title, because so often the poem can change the meaning of the title. And it's just always my practice to go back and, or it's not even a practice, it's just my instinct to go back and reread the title. And so I love that, the way that that the dying light of stars is both you know, the dying light, meaning the light that is decreasing, the light that is dying, but it is also the light of stars. The stars are dying, right? And they are giving off light as they do. It's like a really, I mean, it kind of is like that love your neighbor as yourself. It's like, it's a very a large kind of concept to hold in your mind at, you know, all at once. I love that. I that happens so often throughout this book, these kind of like huge questions that come up, or these huge sort of dichotomies that are presented. I really love that.
Thanks. The one thing I should say about the title is actually a lot of the pieces in my book are titled after pieces of art. And this is one of them. The title actually comes from a piece by a Native American visual artist named Sky Hopinka, who I found in last year's Whitney Biennial. And so the title is the title of a piece of art by Sky Hopinka also.
Is it a representational piece of artwork, or is it abstract?
It's actually video art.
Oh, okay. Does it have to do with the sort of experience of being an American?
I think to some extent, a lot of Sky Hopinka's work deals with what it means to be indigenous mm-hmm. in America right now. So to that effect, yes. Mm. And part of I think using that title was not only the literal meaning, but a lot of the book also for me has to do with this idea of the Jewish idea of galut, of exile. Mm-hmm. Because I live in rural Appalachia, I live in rural Southwest Virginia, and I'm one of the few Jewish people in the town I live in. A lot of what I'm trying to figure out when I write is where I fit in. And also as someone who's the daughter of a refugee and an immigrant, because I'm first generation American, and my mom was literally stateless, that sense of displacement for me as someone who's a native New Yorker and is now in the South is something that pervades my writing a lot, I think.
Do you think of yourself now as a Virginian, or do you think of yourself as a New Yorker?
It's a really interesting question, because I've lived most of my adult life at this point in the state of Virginia. By happenstance, I went to grad school here too, so I've been living here since my 20s. But I still don't feel of this place, even though often I'm included in compilations of Southern poets. There are certain things about the South that still feel very, very alien to me. And so in my heart, I feel like I'm still a New Yorker, but then I go back to New York and I wonder if I still fit in there.
I have similar feelings and experiences about, it's not such a dramatic geographical distance. I grew up in southern New Mexico and live in Austin, Texas, and I have lived here since graduate school as well. So I've lived here a very long time, and I struggle with figuring out which of these places I belong to, or if I belong to either of them.
And I also think both those places are places with really strong identities. Like, being a Texan is like a thing.
Oh, it's a thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yours as well. I mean, your experiences as well.
Being in a place where, you know, the Walmart is more of a town center than any place else in town is definitely an experience I think a lot of people across the country can share, but not maybe a whole lot of people are writing about.
Yeah. It's important. I mean, it's important. That's why your voice is so important. You are in some ways like a documentarian as well as a poet, or, you know, often poets are like documentarians. You mentioned you went to graduate school in Virginia. Did you go to the same school where you teach now?
No, I went to UVA in Charlottesville.
Okay. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about when and how you came to write poetry and came to think of yourself as a poet, or just how did that happen, and how old were you?
I was always drawn towards poetry in the form of song lyrics, like most good middle schoolers. But as someone who had immigrant parents, English wasn't either of my parents' first languages, I didn't actually know that there were living poets until a friend of mine from high school took me to see Allen Ginsberg. I think it was like our junior year. We took the train into Manhattan because we were living at that point on Long Island. And he took me to see Allen Ginsberg, who came out in a flowing white caftan and did a poetry reading with bongo drums. And when I saw that, I thought, oh my God, that's a thing you can do? Like, I didn't even know that was an option. And it wasn't really until college that I started writing poetry seriously, although I had always been writing poetry in high school, and realizing through the fact that I had teachers who did this that you could be a practicing poet and like not Allen Ginsberg and a human and teach, and that this was an actual career some people had. But having immigrant parents, I also started college as pre-med and then practically flunked all my chemistry and math classes. So I think like a lot of kids from either working class or immigrant backgrounds, careers in the arts were not necessarily promoted by my family. And so I've always had these like weird backup plans to support myself. It's interesting that you mentioned documentary, because I worked in, before I became what I'd say is like a career poet, whatever that means, I worked in documentary film. Like, I lifeguarded my way through college. I worked programming computers. I worked for Merrill Lynch. Like, I had all of these extra skills, even to the point where I stayed in grad school for an extra 7 years working on a PhD in religion, because I didn't think I'd ever be able to get a job as a poet. And so it's very, I think it's terrifying for artists to suddenly have their income tied to their art. It's a scary thing.
Yeah. That's true. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about, I've been having this experience lately where, you know, poets that I have been reading for a long time, like you and Ada and Amy, who you know, suddenly I realize like, oh, you know, we've all been at this a very long time now. You know, this is your this is your fifth book of poems. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how things have changed in your writing life over the course of your career so far. Obviously, you know, you have a huge career ahead of you as well. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where you have come, you know, as opposed to where you started.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. When my first book got published, it was in, I think, 2003 or 4. And it was really the infancy of the internet. The internet, like, wasn't a thing, to the point where I so clearly remember this. I have a terrible sense of direction. And I went on book tour through Florida for my first book of poems. And I had sold one of my poems to Slate, who at that time, Robert Pinsky, was their poetry editor. And I had made enough money to buy one of the first GPSs ever made that was like literally this almost the size of a toaster, I think, on my dashboard. And I called it the honorary Robert Pinsky GPS, because there was no, like, you couldn't get directions to places online. And I had visions of myself like driving through the Everglades forever. But I think one of the things about the internet means that poetry is much easier to disseminate, you know, whether it's a link to a podcast or radio show or a poem that goes viral, or the way that we spread work around even to each other. You know, it used to be me selling books out of the trunk of my car, basically. I felt like those guys standing on the corner selling wristwatches out of their overcoats in the city. And so I think it was much more face-to-face in terms of some of the stuff initially that I started doing to become parts of the poetry communities. I talked about the Ginsberg reading earlier, but one of the ways I found out about poetry also was through the Nuyorican Cafe in New York back in the 90s, where poetry and spoken word were being done in ways that you had to show up in person. You know, the internet has changed poetry to the extent of we don't have to show up in person. We can disseminate work and have people read our work and have really robust responses from people all virtually. And so I think to me, that's been the biggest change is the way that we disseminate work, which isn't to say I don't go on the road. I actually love doing readings and going out into communities because I still think that's a really amazing way to bring poetry, which is both an oral O-R-A-L and oral A-U-R-A-L art. But to me, the internet, to some extent, has like totally changed the landscape of what we do.
Do you think it's had an effect on the way that you make work?
It has in terms of my process. You know, for me as a writer, one of the biggest things that's changed over 5 books and like basically 15 years or more of writing and publishing, I guess more than that, like almost 18, is that I had children. And it turns out, at least for me, I got much more efficient as a writer after I had children. But I also have these online writing groups that I participate in where we'll decide to write a poem a day, let's say, for the entire month of June. And we just show up in a Google group and post a poem a day. We don't even give each other feedback on them. But just that group accountability of having to come with a poem every day, to me, has also revolutionized the way I write. And I've been doing that for about now over 10 years with a group that changes a little bit, but has some of the same members over those 10 years.
I'm just remembering that I was in one of those groups, I think, for a month. I did that with you
once. I think you were. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's so great that you, I didn't realize that that's something that you have practiced over such a long period of time. Do you write a poem a day? Is that something you do?
Not normally, only when I'm part of an online group that requires it. Like even this, during the semesters, it gets very hectic and it's complicated for me to write. I do most of my writing over breaks in summer, but I have a little group of like 3 of us that have promised every Friday we would send a poem to each other. And that's going to bring me to the page and make me write in ways that I normally wouldn't if I didn't have that group accountability. And it's not that I wouldn't eventually make the same art. It's just kind of steps up the process a little bit, I think.
Yeah. I love that. And I love hearing it because I think that sometimes people think that writers are just, you know, constantly dipping into an endless wellspring of inspiration. And, you know, you write when inspiration hits and it's not hard to fit it into your life. You know, the rest of your life has to happen as well. And so I love that, you know, it's like, that's just such a human thing. It's like Jenny Craig for poetry. You know what I mean? Like, it's like an accountability group for poetry.
I do think the thing is, it's like I'm always like I'm a poetic pack rat and sort of a materials pack rat. So I'm always collecting, whether it's like taking a photo of an image I want to remember or jotting something down on my iPhone notepad or in a little notebook I have. So I'm always collecting. Uh-huh. It's just like that final push to actually turn what it is I'm noticing or feeling or want to wrangle with into the poem comes with that group accountability. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like in some ways, not necessarily like I'm constantly drawing on this wellspring, but because my work is very often externally oriented towards the world, mm-hmm. I'm always noticing stuff and collecting it and trying to like keep it in places where I can come back to it.
I love that you said externally, I'm writing it down, externally oriented to the world, because I wanted to ask you in the least annoying way possible. like what I, one of the things I really admire about your work, and I think that it's, you know, especially clear in this book and in that idea that we were talking about earlier, like that you've picked up this phrase that, I mean, you know, entire religions are based on the phrase, love your brother or love your neighbor as yourself, right? Mm-hmm. It's that this is like the philosophical foundation for so much of our culture, maybe aspirationally. So I just
or used to be.
Yeah, right. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what it means for you to approach topics that might be classified by someone with a limited vocabulary like myself as being political poems, you know? I know some people kind of bristle at that term, because your poems are not, of course, only, you know, I think people think of political poems as being really preachy. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how you as a poet approach that, or how you get to that externally oriented position, or that if that's just sort of your natural entryway.
Let me tackle two slightly different things. So one is that as someone who initially, like during college and after college, worked in documentary film, I've always been really interested in other people's stories. And I think when I decided to keep going in grad school and do a PhD in religion that I never finished, my work was in religious anthropology. So what I was trying to figure out is basically the question of how do other people live, and what rituals do they do, and what does it mean to them? And so as part of my fieldwork, I interviewed a ton of people and just kind of went around and asked them literally about how they were living around various topics. And so I think other people have always fascinated me, in some cases more so than my own kind of internal sensibilities. And so I think that sort of documentary element to me, then it sort of necessarily becomes tied to this idea of the political, when we're living in this era of kind of late stage capitalism, when we're living, you know, even my own personal background as someone whose grandparents survived Auschwitz and who comes from an immigrant family, and then I live in the Appalachian South in the 21st century, and I'm raising one white son and one black son down here, means that every time I even go to the supermarket with my children, when we adopted my second son, the adoption agency said, okay, now you're what we term a conspicuous family, meaning we don't look the same as other families and we don't look the same as each other. And it means that every time I physically move my body in space with my children, we become a kind of political entity. And so for the past 5 years since my second son came to us, I haven't felt like I could extricate myself from any kind of, I haven't felt like I could be sort of non-political or inconspicuous. But also, I think even before that, with some of the stuff I was writing about in terms of gun culture and gun violence, in my personal life, I teach at Virginia Tech, and I showed up here in 2007, right after what was then the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. And everybody who's a parent in this day and age, all of our kids have had to participate in lockdown drills, or in some cases, actual lockdowns. And so I feel like we're all living in this moment where politics impacts us, whether we have to, you know, take our kid to the emergency room and worry about how we're going to pay for it, or, you know, have that automatic phone call that comes from the school that your kids are in lockdown, or anything, means that we're part of a political moment. And that's the kind of stuff that ends up working its way into my work, because it's part of my daily life.
Yeah, I think that it's time for that term to become, it's almost like there needs to be a better word, a better term for it, in the same way that confessional poetry didn't really describe those poets very well. Political poetry doesn't describe what you know, poets like you or so many poets are doing. It's like, I love that idea that it's just in your nature to be sort of externally oriented. I find that to be such a wonderful quality of a person, and also of a poet, you know, to be always looking out and seeing. It's interesting, I didn't realize that you had a history in documentary filmmaking, but now that, of course, that seems totally obvious to me now. I love the...
It's interesting. I was just going to say, can I say one thing about the poem I read? I'll remember you as you were, not as what you'll become.
Yes, please.
So that poem is really interesting in that I actually wrote it on commission. Our art center on campus puts a poem on their stair risers every 6 months. They usually change it up. And they asked if I had anything for the risers. And so where the stanza breaks fall in the poem are actually where the landings of the stairs were. I wrote it for this external physical place that was public. And one of the things they asked me to do was actually take out the word America in that poem so it could be read as slightly less political and wouldn't offend any of their donors. It's interesting how even one word in a poem can weight it towards more political or less political.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that they asked you to write a poem, like they have this many steps and this many landings, and would you write a poem that fits that physical space? And is that what they're, that's what they asked you to do?
Yes.
That's remarkable. Wow. That's kind of like one of the greatest writing, that would be just a great writing exercise, like to take a class out and go, like, go find a physical space in the world, you know, a stairway or, you know, bricks on a wall, and try to figure out how, what your poem would look like. And then, you know, so you need 60, you have 16 bricks, so you have 16 lines or something. It's just another way of like putting a slight, you know, constricting element onto a poet, which very often yields great stuff.
And I think public poetry is the most amazing thing. I mean, like, my goal before I die is to have a poem on the subway.
Right.
That's all I want before I die.
Yeah.
And even I know a lot of friends who do various, especially during National Poetry Month, sort of like these dive bombing poetry things where they'll tape poems using painter's tape to public places, mm-hmm. or hang them from trees in the woods laminated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really fun thing.
Yeah, to experience poetry where you don't expect to experience poetry, even as a poet who reads poetry all the time. I was in New York City for a wedding this summer. We got on the subway and there was a Merwin poem, like, right, you know, right,
yeah,
next to my head. And I was just like, this is so great. You know, I was just like blown away by it. And I love the idea that you would love to have one in the subway, because those are like your stomping grounds, you know, like, to me, I don't think it would be the subway. It would be like Smoky Bear National Monument would like put up a poem of mine or something. Like White Sands or something. That's so great. So I know that we are on the timer. So I wondered if I asked you to bring in a poem that you wanted to share, like, you know, just a poem to share with the world. I think that poets are the greatest choosers of poems, right? As much as I love hearing how someone came to be a poet, I also just love, like, what is your number one? Like, if you have one shot to, like, share a poem by someone else with the world, what poem would it be? So what poem would it be for you?
That is such the hardest question ever. And I have to tell you, when I knew I had to do this, I agonized and I couldn't even decide. I brought a whole tote bag of books from my house to my work office just to figure out at the last minute what I was going to read, because picking one is like, it's horrible. It's a horrible thing to have to do.
I know. Because you have to leave all the others behind.
I know, and I was torn between a cityscape poem and a sort of incantatory prayer-like poem. I'm going to go ahead and read the more uplifting prayer-like poem, and it's a poem called Roots by Lucille Clifton. Roots. Call it our craziness, even. Call it anything. It is the life thing in us that will not let us die. Even in death's hand, we fold the fingers up and call them greens and grow on them. We hum them and make music. Call it our wildness, then. We are lost from the field of flowers. We become a field of flowers. Call it our craziness, our wildness. Call it our roots. It is the light in us. It is the light of us. It is the light. Call it whatever you have to. Call it anything.
Oh, man, that poem is so great. I'm so glad you chose that poem.
I love that poem.
She has such a way of just making, you know, the act of naming or the act of calling. It's such a fundamentally important thing. And that I'm thinking of the poem "Here There Be Dragons," another poem by Lucille Clifton.
Starts
out like something about like what so many languages have fallen off the face of the earth into the dragon's mouth. And just like the power of language is such a theme throughout her work.
I also love that poem because it talks about this sort of, and even in the poem, I think she's struggling in there to give this feeling mm-hmm. of survival, the survivalist thing, whatever it is in us that allows us to keep going. She's struggling to name it in here and ultimately kind of gives up in the end.
Yes.
You know, call it whatever you have to, call it anything.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we all kind of know what she's talking about, even while she's struggling to get at it in this poem.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. The sort of way that her poems and so many poems, I think about that in the poem that you shared with us. I'll remember you as you were, not as what you'll become, that there's a, you know, the thing, that thing in poetry where you can kind of hold like hope, a sense of hopelessness and hopefulness together and have that experience mm-hmm. like on the page. And then also the experience of the reader is that they are doing the same thing in their experience of the poem. So it's just, it's kind of like a, it's a whole orchestration of things that's going on. And it's very difficult, I think, to do that. And I love that poem that you just read. And I also love the poem that you shared of your own.
Thank you.
Erica, it's been so wonderful to talk to you. I'm going to let you go because I know that you have to run to a meeting now.
Thank you, Carrie. And thank you so much for being so enthusiastic about my work. I so appreciate it. And I love your work, too.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you so much. Yes, I am.
And I'm so glad so many people are reading your novel.
Oh, yes. It's very funny to have a YA novel in the world. Yeah. It's really remarkable. It's like so different than having a book of poems in the world. It really is. And it's different in such strange ways because a lot of it is that, like, it seems a lot more, it's a novel. It has nothing to do with my life at all. It's a story. And yet it feels so much more personal in a way than poetry does.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting. And
you
it
should
is,
do a panel on that.
Oh, yeah. The YA, right? The poet going into the YA. There are so many poets who are publishing YA. So many great poets. Erica Sanchez.
I know. It'd be a great panel. It would be like you, yeah. Erica Sanchez. Who am I missing?
Oh, is she going to be on your panel? You're going to do something with her.
No, but.
Are you doing something with her?
No, but the panel you should put together for next
yes,
year
right, right.
should be
I thought
you
I saw,
and her and all the other cool people.
I thought saw you post something about how Erica and you guys were going to do something together. No?
Oh, we are. We're doing the Poetry World series in New York City.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so awesome. All right.
Yeah.
I'll let you go. And I'll talk to you soon. And I hope to see you at AWP, Erica.
That would be great. Let's do cocktails.
Yes. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can find I'll Remember You As You Were, Not As What You'll Become in Erica Meitner's new book, Holy Moly Carry Me, out now from BOA Editions. This Is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.